What if the deepest psychological traumas of war aren't just invisible wounds of the mind, but, literal physical brain damage that standard medicine is completely ignoring?
Yeah, I mean, it is a complete reframing of how we understand suffering.
Welcome to the deep dive. For decades, we've treated psychiatric conditions as if they were entirely separate from the physical body. But today, we're exploring a profound medical paradigm shift that's basically tearing down that wall. We are looking at the hard neuroscience of veterans, combat trauma, and psilocybin.
And to guide us today, we are looking at a really comprehensive peer-reviewed synthesis. It was published on June 4th, 2026, in the OOTW Journal. It's titled Veterans and Psilocybin: The Neuroscience of Healing the Wounds of War.
All right.
The mission here is to look past the cultural noise, right, and examine the actual biological machinery of trauma.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because to understand why this shift is happening now, we have to look at the baseline reality for you, the listener, to grasp the stakes. And the stakes are just incredibly high. The standard of care for our veterans is struggling to keep up with the crisis.
Yeah, the grim reality, which is pulled straight from recent VA annual reports, is that we are seeing 17.6 veteran suicides per day in the U.S.
Wow.
Right? And that rate is approximately twice that of non-veteran adults. And sadly, that number has remained tragically stagnant for over two decades now.
Which is just heartbreaking.
It is. What that data tells us, objectively, is that the current standard of care treatments have a roughly 50% failure rate for veterans. So today's discussion, it isn't about psychedelic mysticism or, alternative lifestyles.
Right, this is science.
Exactly. It is a strictly hard science look at how combat trauma physically breaks four specific neural systems and how psilocybin is the first pharmacological intervention shown to engage all four of those simultaneously.
But before we jump into those four systems, we really need to understand what that 50% failure rate actually looks like on the ground. Like if a veteran walks into a clinic today seeking help for PTSD, what's the process they typically go through and where is it breaking down?
Well, the first line of defense is pharmacological. The FDA and VA endorsed drugs for PTSD are SSRIs, so things like sertraline.
Okay.
But the clinical data reveals a glaring limitation. These medications only produce a 20 to 30% full remission rate in this specific population.
So the vast majority are just not finding complete relief there.
Not at all.
So if the medication doesn't fully work, the next step is usually therapy, right?
Yes, specifically trauma-focused psychotherapies, things like prolonged exposure and cognitive processing therapy.
Which sound intense.
Very. And the dropout rates for veterans in these programs are massive. We're talking ranging from 38.5% up to as high as 65% in some of these clinical trials.
Wait, 65%. Why are so many people walking away from the primary therapy that's supposed to help them?
Well, just imagine being asked to repeatedly and vividly recount the most terrifying, devastating moments of your entire life, week after week.
I can't even imagine.
Now imagine doing that while your brain's fear center is physically stuck in a state of hypersensitization. The therapy essentially demands that you walk back into the fire, but it doesn't give you a biological fireproof suit.
So it's just excruciating for them.
It's agonizing. And when the SSRIs fail and the therapy is too agonizing to endure, veterans often fall into what the medical literature calls the polypharmacy trap.
Okay, I want to focus on that phrase, the polypharmacy trap, because this really seems to be where the situation spirals. Like, you take an SSRI and it doesn't clear the trauma.
Right.
So a doctor prescribes an atypical antipsychotic to help with the hyperarousal.
Exactly.
Then maybe a benzodiazepine to calm the panic attacks, then an opioid because, you're also dealing with comorbid chronic pain from your service.
Yeah, and suddenly the veteran is managing a cocktail of heavy medications, and each one is just treating a symptom or a side effect of another drug.
That's a trap, for sure.
The result is that 27.5% of these veterans become entirely treatment resistant. And then you layer on top of that the fact that one in four U.S. veterans screens positive for probable traumatic brain injury, or TBI.
It's just a compounding issue.
It really is. The system systematically burns out the most severely affected individuals because it's fundamentally mismatched to the injury. Current treatments target just one single node, like serotonin reuptake, and they hammer it chronically every single day.
It sounds like trying to fix a house with a fundamentally cracked foundation by just relentlessly painting the walls, and then wondering why the house is still sinking.
Yeah, that's a great way to look at it.
You're just asking the rest of the brain to follow along and pretend the structure is sound.
If we connect this to the bigger picture,
Yeah.
that is a very accurate way to visualize it. We aren't fixing the foundation. We aren't utilizing plasticity windows.
Plasticity windows.
Yeah, these are brief, discrete periods where the brain is actually malleable enough to enact deep structural change.
Okay, so let's look at how we actually pour new concrete for that foundation using those windows. The OTW Journal Synthesis outlines four specific neural systems that psilocybin actively targets to rebuild the brain.
Right, let's go through them.
Let's start with the threat detection center, the amygdala. In combat PTSD, this area gets dialed up into a state of chronic hyperreactivity, right? It's constant hypervigilance.
And acutely, meaning during the actual hours the psilocybin is in the person's system, the drug dampens the amygdala's response. It quiets that blaring alarm.
So they can finally take a breath.
Exactly. This is vital because it allows the veteran to safely bring up and face the traumatic memory without being immediately flooded by sheer panic.
Wait, if it just turns down the fear center, isn't that exactly what an SSRI does? Like, doesn't that just leave the person numb?
That is the crucial distinction here. SSRIs are taken daily, and they often result in emotional blunting. They turn the volume down on everything, the joy as well as the fear. Psilocybin operates completely differently. Post-treatment, after the drug has completely left the body, it doesn't leave the amygdala suppressed. It recalibrates it.
Recalibrates.
Yes. Studies show the amygdala's reactivity actually returns to a healthy responsive level. But the psilocybin restores the authority of the prefrontal cortex over it.
Ah, the prefrontal cortex being the brain's logical braking system.
Yes. It reestablishes top-down control. The research describes this as reopening emotional bandwidth. The veteran gets their full spectrum of feelings back, but the steering wheel is finally reattached.
That's incredible. But trauma isn't just a physical panic reflex, is it? I mean, for a lot of people, the trauma fundamentally alters how they see themselves. It weaves itself into their actual identity.
Right. And this brings us to the second neural system, the default mode network, or the DMN.
Okay, the DMN.
You can think of the DMN as the brain's autobiography center. It's the network that hums along when you are thinking about who you are, your past, and your future.
Your sense of self.
Exactly. In severe PTSD, the DMN becomes pathologically overcoupled with the anterior hippocampus.
And the hippocampus is where memories live.
Yes. Mm-hmm. It is the exact physical location where trauma memories are stored.
So the memory center and the identity center get fused together.
And the clinical result is that the trauma becomes the self. The veteran's internal narrative shifts to, I am the trauma, I am permanently damaged, and the world is entirely hostile.
It's like a computer operating system that has completely locked up because of one massive corrupted application.
Yeah.
You can't open a web browser, you can't move the mouse because 100% of the processing power is dedicated to this frozen trauma app. So how does psilocybin intervene in that fused network?
Well, what's fascinating here is a major 2024 study published in Nature demonstrated that psilocybin acts as a force reboot.
A reboot.
It powerfully desynchronizes that connection between the memory center and the identity center. It does not erase the memory. I mean, this isn't some sci-fi memory wipe.
Right, they still remember it.
But what it does is temporarily loosen the rigid identification between the self and the event.
So the memory is still there, but it's no longer the sole defining feature of the operating system.
Exactly. And that desynchronization lasts for weeks after a single dose.
Mm.
It opens a massive window for integration therapy. The narrative can finally be updated because the patient isn't biologically forced to view themselves entirely through the lens of their worst day.
Okay, so the trauma is untethered from their identity. They have distance from it. But, you know, they still have a physical reflex to hit the deck when they hear a loud noise, like a car backfiring. How does the brain actually unlearn a physical hardwired reflex?
That is the third mechanism, rewiring the fear extinction circuit.
Fear extinction.
Yeah. PTSD is largely a failure to unlearn fear. Evolutionarily, we acquire fear very quickly to keep us alive in dangerous situations, right?
Oh, no.
But we are supposed to slowly unlearn it or extinguish it when we return to safety. That unlearning process requires a physical bridge in the brain. A specific synaptic connection that signals safety.
And combat stress damages that bridge.
It does. Chronic stress and sleep deprivation physically degrade the synaptic plasticity in that circuit.
Wow.
The brain literally loses the biological hardware required to learn that it is safe again. This is where the structural repair comes in.
Okay.
A 2021 study in the journal Neuron revealed that a single dose of psilocybin creates a neuroplastic window where there is a 10% increase in dendritic spine density and head size in the frontal cortex.
Wait, a 10% increase. It is literally growing new physical branches on the neurons to rebuild that broken safety bridge.
It is rapid, persistent structural neuroplasticity, and it goes hand in hand with the fourth mechanism, quieting the brain's neuroinflammatory storm.
Inflammatory storm.
The synthesis explains that chronic combat stress primes the brain's immune cells, the microglia, into a deeply pro-inflammatory state.
Okay, hold on. I have to stop you there because this is where the biology gets really counterintuitive for me. You're saying that a psychological stressor, like the fear of combat, creates a literal, measurable immune response and physical inflammation in the brain. How does a bad memory trigger an immune system panic?
Comes down to evolutionary biology. When early humans were under severe stress, say being hunted by a predator, the body assumed a physical wound was imminent.
Oh, I see.
So the brain preemptively flooded the system with immune cells and inflammatory alarms to fight off potential infection. Now transplant that ancient survival mechanism into modern combat. A soldier is under severe life-threatening stress for months on end,
So the brain's immune system gets stuck in the on position.
constantly releasing heavy-duty inflammatory alarms, things like TNF-alpha and IL-1 beta.
So the brain is constantly preparing for a physical wound that either already happened or never came, and that chronic immune response becomes its own disease.
Exactly. This drives what we call central sensitization of pain. The emotional trauma and the chronic physical pain are literally sharing the same biological fuel.
That is a massive paradigm shift.
You cannot talk therapy away a neuroimmune storm. But psilocin, which is the active compound the body converts psilocybin into, it operates through specific serotonin receptors to actively suppress those inflammatory alarms.
So if we step back and look at the whole board here, we have the threat center recalibrated, the identity network rebooted, the safety bridge physically rebuilt, and the brain's immune fire put out.
That's the four.
This incredible biological alignment brings us to a specific, deeply burdensome wound of war that people rarely discuss openly. What happens when the trauma isn't driven by panic, but by guilt?
You are talking about moral injury. This is distinct from fear-based PTSD. Moral injury is defined as the profound guilt, shame, and self-revulsion that arises from violating one's own deeply held moral code in a high-stakes environment.
So it's not fear, it's something heavier.
Exactly. It might be an action taken, an order followed, a failure to prevent harm, or simply something they witnessed. It affects an estimated 25 to 50% of combat veterans.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. How do scientists actually know that moral injury is a different biological entity from standard PTSD? Like, how do you measure a feeling like guilt versus a feeling like fear on a brain scan?
Functional MRI scans show a clear distinction. Resting state fMRI work reveals that moral injury lives entirely in the default mode network.
The identity and self-narrative center we discussed earlier.
Yes, it does not show up in the amygdala sphere circuit.
Oh, wow. So if a veteran is suffering primarily from crushing guilt and the VA gives them an SSRI or puts them through prolonged exposure therapy?
It entirely misses the biological target.
Because it's aiming at fear.
Exactly. Those standard treatments are calibrated to address the fear circuit. They don't reach deep into the default mode network. Because psilocybin profoundly and durably resets the DMN, it is currently the only known pharmacological intervention with a plausible mechanistic claim on healing the actual biological substrate of moral injury.
So why isn't this the immediate standard of care for moral injury right now?
Well, because there is a gap in the clinical science. The biological alignment makes perfect sense, but proving clinical efficacy is difficult because most clinical trials haven't adopted standard endpoints to measure moral injury yet.
Ah, they aren't testing for it specifically.
There are validated tools out there, like the SSM scale, which measures moral injury symptoms. But until large trials use those scales as primary endpoints, the evidence remains theoretical on paper.
Even if the individual clinical reports from veterans are overwhelmingly positive,
Right.
let's talk about those clinical realities for the listener wondering if this is still just lab theory or if it's actually happening in the real world right now in 2026. What does the clinical data and regulatory landscape look like?
The landscape has evolved rapidly. In December 2025, Mount Sinai published an open-label trial looking at U.S. veterans with severe treatment-resistant depression. They administered a single 25-milligram dose of psilocybin.
One dose.
The results at 3 weeks showed a 60% response rate and 53% were in full remission.
Over half of the veterans completely in remission from severe treatment-resistant depression after a single dose.
Based on convergent data like that, there is now a 9-facility VA network stretching from the Bronx to San Diego, actively running protocols.
And the legislation is reflecting this urgency, too. Now, we want to look at this completely impartially, just presenting the facts of the regulation as they are in our sources. We're not taking any sides here.
Of course.
The fiscal year 2024 National Defense Authorization Act included a $10 million provision specifically for active duty research. What's notable is the broad bipartisan support it received, championed by political figures on the right like Morgan Luttrell and Dan Crenshaw, alongside figures on the left like Ro Khanna and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
It's a very unique bipartisan issue.
And following that, an April 2026 presidential executive order allocated a minimum of $50 million for research. In addition, state-level pathways in Oregon and Colorado are currently providing access.
Yeah, we are looking at an explosion of infrastructure that simply did not exist a few years ago.
So what does this all mean? Let's ground this for a moment. If someone listening right now is a veteran or loves a veteran, what is the actual hurdle preventing widespread access today?
This raises an important question, because the honest gap is that no large veteran-specific randomized controlled trial for psilocybin and PTSD has published its final results yet.
So the data isn't final.
The science is incredibly convergent, but it hasn't crossed the final regulatory finish line for this specific population. Furthermore, there is a massive practical hurdle. Remember the polypharmacy trap?
Yeah, all the stacked medications.
Chronic use of SSRIs severely downregulates the brain's serotonin receptors. This means it weakens or completely blocks the effects of psilocybin.
Oh, wow. So a veteran who has been on daily antidepressants for 5 years can't just take psilocybin on a weekend and expect a miracle.
Exactly. It requires a medically supervised 4 to 6 week taper and washout period just to return the brain to a baseline where the psilocybin can even engage the receptors.
That sounds like a rigorous, difficult medical process.
It is. And this is exactly why the OTW Journal highlights curated portals like eatowveterans.com. It is not a clinic, and it doesn't sell anything.
Right.
It acts as a compass, pointing veterans toward active clinical trials, peer-reviewed literature, and established support organizations to help navigate a very complex transition.
It is incredibly complex, but the underlying shift is deeply hopeful. To bring all these threads together, we are moving away from a broken standard of care that relies on polypharmacy to merely mask symptoms while the underlying damage remains untouched.
Yeah.
Instead, we are looking at an intervention that recalibrates the hypervigilant threat center, untethers the trauma identity, literally grows new branches to rebuild the brain's safety bridges, and extinguishes the physical fire of neuroinflammation.
And why this matters so fundamentally for you listening is that we are witnessing a shift from chronically managing a psychiatric disorder to biologically repairing physical brain architecture, all within a discrete window of time.
It is a totally new way of viewing the mind. And as we wrap up, there's one final provocative thought buried in these sources that builds on everything we've just discussed. We noted earlier that 1 in 4 U.S. veterans screens positive for traumatic brain injury.
Right. TBI.
And briefly mentioned in the literature was a January 2024 study using a different psychedelic, ibogaine, on special operations veterans heavily burdened with severe TBIs. That study showed an 88% reduction in PTSD symptoms.
It is a staggering result that forces us to ask a profound question. If psychedelics can rapidly grow new dendritic branches, if they can physically repair synaptic connections, and if they can directly suppress physical neuroinflammation,
yeah.
Could the future of treating physical brain trauma rely on these exact same neuroplastic windows? Could this apply to concussions, blast injuries, or even CTE in athletes and civilians?
That's incredible.
Are we looking at a near future where these compounds aren't just viewed as psychiatric medicine, but are prescribed essentially as physical therapy for the brain?
Yeah.
Physical therapy for the brain. For decades, we've looked at the invisible wounds of war like a broken bone that wouldn't show up on an x-ray. We couldn't see the damage, so we didn't know how to set the fracture. We just kept painting the walls of a house with a cracked foundation.
Yeah.
But the neuroscience is finally showing us the physical cracks, and more importantly, it is handing us the concrete to rebuild the foundation. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the standard of care and keep exploring.